The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
You want to say Tfilat HaDerech? What is Tfilat HaDerech? It's a prayer for the journey. Amen. All right, good job. That is the official third-party liability insurance policy. The prayer for the journey. All right, what I'm going to do now, we're going to make our last stop for the day. So we're going to go into our lunch foot. But before we do that, we're going to take a bus ride past the oak tree, the Alon, that they used to be able to see from the distance. Okay? Now, this road ahead of us is that flat strip that was used as an airport. That's Kfar Etzion over there on that hill to reorient you. Now we're making a right. Here we haven't been yet. Okay? This is the Matnas, the Regional Educational Center for Gush Etzion, separate from the one in Efrat. Award-winning schools, elementary school, my daughter's high school is here. It's an incredible school. That tower that you can see on your left was a tourist tower. And you'll notice when we pass by, okay, I'm going to show you. If you look on your left right now, you'll see ahead of us here this impressive-looking wide tree. Okay, it's up of dead, the lone tree. And this is the oak tree. And you'll see these stones, these monuments. We're not going to get off the bus. Those stones, each of those stones is a monument to a different settlement that fell and the people who fell there. And this oak tree was visible to the north, which is directly ahead of us, because there was nothing else here. This was all barren. There were no trees here. There were no buildings here. There were no telephone wires here. There was only this tree. So it sounds funny today to call it the lonely tree, because for 19 years, this tree was all alone, and now we've come home, and it's got lots of friends and lots of neighbors. But people still come here to tell the story of a different time. Right, I'll tell you something else interesting about this oak tree. This oak tree is almost 600 years old. Uh-huh, it's been dated. Kind of wonder which tzaddik sat under that tree 600 years ago, right? Okay, now, we're basically going here to turn around, but I wanted you to see this. Look down to your left in the distance, and you will see the city of Beitar. Okay? This is one of the most beautiful views in Israel. Beitar, which is just the curve of the mountain, you're going to see it much more clearly below you to your left in a minute. To your right, by the way, is the Patriarch's Route, Derech HaAvot. This is the road that leads directly to Jerusalem. It's an old Roman road with Roman markers dating back to the time of Abraham. Beitar is an interesting experiment. First of all, it sits right near the ancient ruins of Batir. We owe the Arabs a debt, because they kept the names from, you know, periods past when we were sort of gone for a while. And very often we've been able to find archaeological excavations of Jewish history because the Arabs hung on to the names. And the other end, which you can't see from here, is the Arab village of Batir. Oh, actually you can. That's it right ahead of you. And it sits on top of the ruins of Beitar, which is where the last stand of the Bar Kokhba rebellion took place. Now this city, Beitar, which is also part of the Gush Etzion Regional Council, although the road there is a little bit roundabout, interesting experiment. It is a completely, I mean, I hate the use of labels, but for the purpose of this discussion, it is what you would call an ultra-Orthodox community, right? Lots and lots and lots of black hats. And these are people who wanted to move out of the city, they believed in settling the land, but they didn't want to compromise on their own, you know, educational agenda, and goals, and therefore they decided to build their own place. And they grew extremely quickly. They're today the largest city in the Gush. The average family, the average number of children per family in Beitar approaches 6. That's the average. Okay, lots and lots of families with 8, 9, 10 kids there. So that is one answer to the demographic time bomb of the Arabs. And today there are about 24,000 people living there. I've heard now, this is 2 years old, those statistics, I've heard now they're past 30,000. 30 new babies a week. By the way, this place that we're in is a kibbutz, it's called Rosh Turin. And this was built by the children of the kibbutz Ein Surim, which was uprooted in 1948. One of the things interesting here is that they farm the orchards that were planted by their fathers, you know, 60 years ago. And in fact, during cherry season, so there's a big custom in the Gush, kibbutz makes good money off it. You can come on a Friday, bring your kids, you pay a certain number of shekels per basket, and you can pick cherries. So about a month ago, we came over here on Friday, must have been 3,000-4,000 people, it was unbelievable. And we descended on the cherry orchards. You know, you teach the kids how to tithe, how to take 10% of the cherries, and give it to tzedakah and put it aside, and the blessings. And you teach them how to pick cherries without damaging the branches. And, you know, you put them on your shoulders and they pick cherries. It's unbelievable. Freshest, most amazing cherries you've ever had. Look ahead of us and you will see very clearly the Beit Midrash, the house of study of Har Etzion, which is where we're going to be visiting. It looks like a bird. I don't know if you can see it. It looks like a big, giant eagle. And that's because it's based on the verse, Al Kanfei Nesharim Esayetchem, I will bring you forth on the wings of eagles. And that eagle is, looks like it's set to take flight, and it's facing Jerusalem to the north behind us. Yes. Sure. Okay, we're entering Alon Shvut. Like I said, named after the Alon, the oak tree. This was built by the children. The children of those who fell in Kfar Etzion, some of them went back to build kibbutz Kfar Etzion. Some of them really didn't want to be kibbutznikim, but they believed in coming back here. So they built this settlement, which is a city, it's a town. It's not a kibbutz. People live here and work out, you know, wherever they work, just like any other normal town. This part is actually the older section. Down below is a much newer section, which we're going to drive past. You can see the difference. You can see how much greenery there is here, because this has been around since 68. Took a while to build up these neighborhoods. The neighborhood that's down to our right, with the beautiful red roofed houses, is only about 5 years old. Now, the yeshiva that I went to, Yeshivat Har Etzion, is located here in Alon Shvut, and I'll talk about that in a minute. The student housing for the guys who are doing rabbinical school, who are studying to be rabbis, are the apartment buildings that we'll pass in a second up here on your left. I was actually, they have a system here. You get basically free housing. It's almost completely free for as long as you're studying to be a rabbi here. And we actually lived here for 2 years, around about the time Yonatan was born. It's a great apartment because you can touch all the walls at the same time. Like, you know, the kitchen that was the study, that was the laundry room, that was the dining room kind of place. But it was great. Great way to start. It was. Alright, we're going to go into this yeshiva. Okay? But I did want to show you just one thing, but I'm just going to describe it to you in the shade rather than in the sun. So, you're starting to get the sense that this is a common occurrence around here, okay? This yeshiva, Har Etzion, which I'll explain to you exactly how it works when we're inside because it's much cooler, does not live on the philosophy of bread and water and suffer in a bench in the cold in the back of a stone hut. You'll see that as we go along. Rav Amital, who's one of the Rosh Yeshiva, believed, you know, the era of studying Torah on a hard bench with your feet in ice water is past. Students today, they need a heated base medrash with beautiful gardens. That's what they built here. Anyway, at a certain point, they were expanding the parking lot here, and they found this. Okay? This is a wine press, which is very clearly a Jewish wine press. And what's interesting about it is, and the first time I discovered this not long after they found it, was when Rav Bick, who was our Rebbe and our Shir, brought us down here to study with us the section in the Tractate of the Talmud where they discuss the issues of purity and impurity, how to make wine. Right? You know, in Israel, you don't study from a book only. You see it with your eyes. It's a whole different type of learning. And what they did was they put these signs here in English so that you can actually see what you're looking at. So we don't have time for you to go through and read all the signs, but it's worth just taking a look as we walk into the Beit Midrash. Hey? Yeah. Hey! How's it going, man? Good to see you. How are you? Shalom Aleichem. Midrash. So they put, right? This was the Beit Bad. This was where they, right? This is where they trampled the grapes. Okay? And this was the Bori Suf. This is where they caught the psalat, the waste, yeah? And they made the wine. This is where it flowed down. And it describes, basically, this is the Mishtach HaDvicha. This is where they trampled it, over here. Okay?
We're going to get to try some?
Pardon?
That was our question. Did they put something on top of it that they stepped on?
Back then? No.
Bare feet?
They were real men.
Did they wash their feet at least?
No. Do you know why they only discovered bacteria like a couple hundred years ago? Because before then, men were tough. Bacteria had no chance. All right, come follow me. It's going to be a wedding year. I love the fact that this pasuk, it's not like, you know, Ma'ahavti Toratecha. How do I love you? How do I love your Torah? Like, the message here is not keep Torah because it's your life. The message is not, you know, Torah Tamima, Torah is pure. It's just, you know, can you love it? Can you learn to love it?
Is this where you studied?
This is where I studied, yeah. What?
Yeah,
pardon? Kol Hayom Hitzichati. All the day it is my conversation. In other words, like, it's not just something I open up a book to do, it's who I am. You know? Oh yeah, it's an interesting story here. So just a little bit about this place, okay? First of all, just as an aside, the person who just passed, I was talking to, is Rav Shlomo Levi, who you may recognize. His brother is Yitzchak Levi, Rav Yitzchak Levi, who's a member of Knesset. He was a minister for many years in the government. Unfortunately, he also became a member of a unique family because he lost his daughter to a terrorist bombing in Machan Yehuda not long ago, a few years ago.
He did, or his brother?
No, his brother did. He's a tremendous Torah scholar. He's the one I told you about who took us down to the mikveh and showed us the Rambam was right, you know. Anyway, he did a bracha under my chuppah, amazing human being. Anyway, walking Torah encyclopedia. A little bit about this place, all right? You know that there's a struggle today in Israel, sociological sort of struggle that we're still going through, between people who believe that everybody should do the army and people who believe that the young men should sit and learn Torah and yeshiva. Okay? And it happens to be a legitimate debate. You can guess that I have an opinion on the matter, but you can only disagree with someone when you respect where they're coming from. Some of us have spoken about this before. I understand the position that says that for 2,000 years we kept our connection to the land of Israel, not because we had an army, and not even because we had a land. We didn't have a land. We kept our connection to it. The reason Judaism stayed alive all these years was because of our heritage, because of the study of Torah. And if we stop studying Torah, then who are we? Then it's just a piece of dirt. And I understand the perspective of those who say, you know, we've been given a land, and we have a responsibility to protect it. There's actually a mitzvah to fight when nations are trying to destroy you, and that is certainly still the case today. So I understand both those perspectives. The problem used to be that you had to make a decision. And if you were someone like me, who felt that you should go to the army, or your son should go to the army, then he basically had to make a decision to go for 3 years to the army. The army is not exactly religiously minded. You can get kosher food, and you don't have to worry about desecrating Shabbat most of the time, but that's about it. You know, everything else, out the window. There's no time for minyan in the morning. There's no studying of Torah. You know, there's no, issues of modesty between, you know, men and women are almost non-existent. I remember one time we were out in the desert. We were doing maneuvers. And as a chupar, as a, like a treat, you know, they showed up with the fire truck from the base. Because every so often they have to switch the water in the fire truck. So why waste all that water? So they brought it out to Shefech. We were like doing tank maneuvers. It was like 100 degrees out. We were all, and you know, it's not like, you know, you don't get to change your uniform every day. All week you're stuck in the same uniform, and it's like sticking to you. So they brought this fire truck, and whenever you'd see one of these, you knew what the story was. Everybody stripped down. They brought these like mishtachim, these wooden platform things that you put crates on, because you're standing in dust and dirt, you know, so it's pudra. And we all get up in these things, and all the guys strip down, and the guy takes out the fire hose, and we start showering. And while this is going on, right, and I'm, you know, I'm like 8 months in the army, whatever it is, I'm as dernick, you know, whatever, no longer, I was a sergeant already. And so a jeep shows up with the company commander, and the pekida plugatit, the girl who, you know, gives out the mail, whatever, she shows up, and she's friendly with all the guys, whatever, and all the guys, and she thinks it's funny, and they think it's funny, and they're all waving, etc. And I'm like, just beyond embarrassment, don't know where to hide, right? And that's like normal in the army, like, you know, so if you're a religious guy and you go into the army and that's the atmosphere, it wears you down. It breaks you down. I remember I had a chayal, Shai Tzinder, who was in the one of the companies that I was in the Bika, right towards the end of my service. And I watched it break him down, you know, he came from a religious kibbutz, and, you know, war kippah. At the beginning when I first got there, he used to come to the makeshift synagogue they had, and he would like pray in the mornings like I did. He's the only other guy with a kippah on the base that I knew of. Little by little, it wore him down. There was one television there. About 3 months, we were on the Jordan Valley doing just sort of being on ready alert, which means you had nothing to do all day. So in the afternoons, the guys would watch TV, like someone had donated a television to the base. And Shabbat afternoon, they had like Wide World of Wrestling or something. So all the guys would get together Shabbos afternoon, and they would all watch wrestling. Now me, it wasn't my speed, obviously. Shabbos, I'm not going to sit and watch TV. So this boy gradually, you know, all his friends are watching TV. They're all watching wrestling. Then they talk about the wrestling matches. So they would say, come, Azov, you're not turning it on. You're not turning it off. What's a big deal? So he would sit with them. Technically, halachically, you could make a case for saying that they were right. I don't think so, but that's irrelevant. If that's your Shabbat is disappearing. Anyway, one day he comes to me. He says, you know, I got a question for you. I don't really know who else to ask. The guys all make fun of me, you know, because I wear a kippah. And they say to me, nu, tinder, tachlit, decide. The dati or the lo dati, religious or not religious, right? If you're religious, what are you doing here with us on Shabbat afternoon? If you're not religious, take off the kippah. Now, why they would say this is an interesting question. Guilt, subconscious, uncomfortable that there's a guy with a kippah. I have no idea. I mean, what do you care? But all right. So he says to me, on the one hand, they're right. Like, I can't say that I'm religious anymore. I'm not into this. I'll eat unkosher food or whatever. On the other hand, I live in a religious kibbutz. I know it'll break my parents' heart if I take my kippah off. They're going through enough with the fact that I'm in a combat unit in the army, so I don't want them to have to deal with this now. So when I'm home for Shabbat, I wear my kippah. So then I'm going to feel even more ridiculous. I take it off in the army, put it back on, like I'll feel like, hey, what do you think I should do? You know, I'm like 20 years old. I mean, I got other things on my mind. I'm not even ready for rabbinical study yet. So the only thing I could think of to say to him was, look, I can't tell you what to do. I can tell you that if you take it off, it'll be much harder to put it back on. So the next day I saw him, and he had decided to keep it on. He just decided to keep it on. That was 6 days before I got out of the army. The day after I got out of the army, that unit was on a patrol on the Jordanian border. A fanatical Muslim Jordanian soldier snuck across the border, ambushed this patrol, and he, along with Rafi Weiss, a sergeant, were killed. And I remember going to the family who was sitting Shiva and, you know, debating, tell them the story, don't tell them the story. In the end, I thought that I would tell them the story because they could know that he decided to keep his kippah on. And they knew the whole time everything that was going on with their son. This is no surprise to them. So it breaks you down. So what do? Go to the army, don't go to the army. So in the mid-60s, a group decided, why should our sons have to choose? Let them have the ability to go to the army, but to do it in a religious atmosphere. So they created what's called the yeshivot, hesder. A hesder is basically a compromise, okay? It means we'll make an arrangement. I don't personally, by the way, think this is a hesder. I actually think this is the ideal, but that's a whole other discussion. These guys don't sign on for 3 years. They sign on for 5 years. And instead of just doing 3 years in the army and you're done and you go to college, they do 5 years. They split their time more or less between the army and religious studies, yeshiva. Many of them stay on after the army. I told some of you the other day, this is a very difficult regimen of study. It starts at 6 in the morning, goes until well after midnight. There are in this yeshiva, I would say about 700 students full-time. There's also a teacher's degree program, which has about 250, 300 students. On Sundays, actually in the summer now, they're in the middle of a 3-day special seminar, which is why you saw all those cars outside. This teacher's degree program is considered the Harvard of Israel. It's people come from all over the world to get their Jewish studies teacher's degree here. Between the rabbinical studies program, the Jewish studies, the yeshiva program, the teacher's degree program, the post, the master's degree program here. There are well over 1,200 students in this yeshiva. So it's a big yeshiva. There are two things that are interesting about this yeshiva. First of all, as much as I can show you for the next 20 minutes, this place, there's a power to a place like this you can't really appreciate unless you come spend time in a place like this. But I'll give you one example that'll make you realize. I remember one year that Dorit was pregnant with Yonatan on Yom Kippur, and we were living in a lunchroom. We were living in that student housing. And, you know, what do you do? You're pregnant. She was due in January. She's like 6 months pregnant, 5 months pregnant. So do you fast? Do you not fast? So the halacha is, you know, you have to get the opinion of a rabbi and a doctor. And rabbis and doctors will agree it's not dangerous for a woman to fast if she's 5, 6 months pregnant. However, if she feels certain things, then she breaks her fast. So therefore, most rabbis rule that a woman should try to fast, but better off to stay home with a fan, in bed, lying and relaxing, and fast, than to go to synagogue, exert yourself, and have to break the fast. Because breaking the fast in Yom Kippur is a serious thing. So we decided, my wife decided she would stay home that year. And as funny as this may sound, it was a little depressing, because the tefillah here is beautiful. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, there's, you know, people come from all over the country, alumni, to come back here to daven. There must be, I don't know, 1,200-1,300 students that are squeezed into this base midrash. And it's not like in a synagogue where you get the guys in front who are into it and the guys in the back who are talking. Nobody comes to yeshiva to talk. So they're all davening, and they all know every single tune because these are the tunes we spent 5 years hearing every year. So it's not like just the congregation sings. It's like a roar. And Rav Amital, the Rosh Yeshiva, he prays the Musaf service. He's an incredible individual. He was a partisan, a Holocaust survivor, fought in the War of Independence, became actually a colonel in the Israeli army, started this yeshiva, has incredible stories, very beloved by all of his students. Back then, he was, you know, in his early 50s, so he still had the energy. Very powerful davening. So I really felt bad that I was leaving my wife. What could you do? And, you know, it's not like, you know, you pray a few hours in the morning and get your big afternoon boca break, right? Here, they go all day. And you know what? You don't notice it. It doesn't bother you. So at the end of the day, I come home. My wife is in this great mood. And I was like, I felt so bad that you missed davening. She goes, I didn't miss any davening. Because I sat in the living room, and 1,000 guys singing the tunes, I heard every word. I was able to follow in the sidur from our apartment. Because the roar of all these guys singing the songs said it was unbelievable. In fact, I thought next year I should invite 9 guys and we should dive in our living room, but we didn't do that. The other thing I want to tell you, which is on a little more serious note, you know, imagine the Yom Kippur War, 1973. We're going to talk about this on Thursday. On October 6, 1973, in the Golan and in Egypt, huge arrays of forces crossed the border. 2,000 tanks crossed the border in the Golan Heights. There were only 2,000 tanks. There were only almost 150 tanks on the entire border. 2,000 tanks. In the Egyptian border, the Egyptian troops crossed the Suez Canal, and they broke through the Barlev line, and Israel was basically on the verge of extinction. So where do you go? On Yom Kippur, most of the troops were on leave because it's Yom Kippur. And there had been a false call-up in May, and the entire army had been called. Now, we only know this in retrospect. The Syrians and the Egyptians had done a maneuver as a fake-out to get Israel to call up her troops. Troops who almost the entire reserve was called up 2.5 weeks, turned out to be a false alarm. So this time they were a little more nervous about doing it. Anyway, the war started and we were caught with our pants down. Where do you go to find frontline combat troops on Yom Kippur? Well, if there's any day of the year when you're going to find all the yeshiva students in the yeshiva, it's Yom Kippur. So the army knew that they could come to a place like this and they could get whole battalions of men. And that's what they did. So these were the first places, the Hezdei Yeshivot, were the first places that army trucks came. On Yom Kippur. Imagine what it is. Right. They didn't know what was going on. They had no phones, they had no radios, right? And it wasn't like their parents were calling them to tell them. People knew that something was up. You heard planes screaming overhead already. They knew something was up. They didn't know what it was. There are no maneuvers in this country on Yom Kippur. So if planes are flying overhead and there are more than two of them, something's going on. Anyway, army officers come running up the steps into the base medrash. You can imagine you're in the middle of Yom Kippur, everybody's in their talisim, and all of a sudden 3-4 army officers run in. You're going to notice them. They walk over to Rav Amital. There's a hurried discussion. Rav Amital bangs on the shtender. Okay? Troops have crossed the border. All the 3rd, 4th, and 5th year guys go back to your rooms. you know, collect your gear. There are trucks here. As quickly as you can, get on the trucks. They'll be taking you up north. And the yeshiva story, actually is that Rav Lichtenstein, right, grabbed a few of the guys and took them aside for 5 minutes and said, okay, first of all, we're going to the kitchen. He went with them to the kitchen, and they raided all the fridges. He said, you must tell the boys that I tell them they must eat on the trucks. You can't go into battle hungry. It's a mitzvah to eat, even though it's Yom Kippur. And they got into a discussion about what you say for the benching when you're eating on Yom Kippur as part of a mitzvah. And then the legend is that as one of the trucks was pulling out, he ran up to them with a whole thing of toilet paper and threw it in the back of the truck, because who thinks of those things? And that is the reason that there was a disproportionately high level of casualties from the Hezer Yeshiva, because they were the guys who came up first to the front lines. This yeshiva alone, this yeshiva was started in 1968, right after the Six-Day War, when we came back here. That's a five-year program. So the fifth-year guys were here in 1973, and they were the first to go. And you know, anything you start in life, the guys you start something with, that's who you really get close with. These were like their children. Rav Amital started this with 30 guys. Of those 30 guys, 11 of them never came home. That's an unbelievable proportion. And you can still hear, to this day, when Rav Amital davens in Yom Kippur, when he prays for the services, you can hear his voice crack and you know exactly what he's thinking of. And I tell you all that because over here is the Beit Midrash. Come over here. This is the Beis Medrash. This is the house of study. We're going to get to see it in a minute from on top. And we'll be quiet up there because I don't want to disturb anybody's learning. It's actually the middle of the summer in the afternoon, so I don't know how many guys are going to be sitting and learning, but nonetheless, this is the entrance to the Beit Midrash. There's actually a beautiful prayer here. That's the prayer that you make before you study Torah, Shelo Tavo Takala Al Yadi, that nobody should, that the Torah that I teach shouldn't cause anybody pain, that it shouldn't be misinterpreted, and so on. I used to say that every morning on the steps here. You can look over there, you can see that there are ponds with fish in them, because there's a verse that says, Al Palgei Mayim. Torah should be like floating on the water. You know, it should be clear and crystal. And so you walk by and you see the water in the windows. And then there's this. This is a memorial. This isn't like the big memorials they make in Washington or even in Israel that are donated by the, you know, Federation from so-and-so. This was made actually by a yeshiva student here. This is just a simple memorial to all the boys from this yeshiva who fell in their wars. These are all the boys, Ha'omdim lefanecha tamid, who stand before you, God, always. The verse is, Ki le'elokim za'aku b'milchama, for to God did they cry out in war. V'ne'ato lahem ki batchu bo. And we will pray for them and to them because they trusted him. V'chol banayich limudei Hashem v'rav shalom banayich. And all your sons are learned of God, and let there be much peace for your sons. And these are the boys who fell in the Yom Kippur War. Asher Yaron, Sariel Birnbaum, Avner Yona, Rafi Neumann, Dani Orlik, Moshe Tal, Amatzia Ilani, Binyamin Ben Igal. And then you have two guys who were killed in Ramat Golan in the War of Attrition afterwards, Benzi Leibovich and Nachum Fenichstein. Yitzhak Lavi was actually killed. It was a tragic story. They were doing a maneuver to sort of be sure that they were on ready alert and prepared. And one of the guys up here accidentally had a live cartridge in his gun, didn't realize it. And as the opposing force stormed the Beis Medrash to see if the Beit Medrash, the guys at the unit here, they used to do army maneuvers here for the guys, somebody opened up and they weren't blanks and one of the boys was killed. It was a terrible story.
Here in the Beis Medrash?
Here, right here. And that's why they stopped doing maneuvers here in the yeshiva. David Buchris, who fell in a terrible army accident. These boys, Weitzman, Rami Mizrahi, David Malik, were friends of mine who died in the Lebanon War. They were killed in the first week of the war. Agala Friedman, who also an amazing guy. In fact, his brother was in the band at my wedding. One of the best looking guys I've ever seen. He walked into a room and he took people's breath away. He's just an unbelievable guy. And he worked with underprivileged kids. Like something out of a movie. He was on a base in Sergeant's Corps, down in Shizafon, and somebody had made a mistake. They were fixing the tanks, and there's a screw in the tank. It's called the Boik Salat, Sivvim Ledaka. It's the screw that you screw in and out in an engine to control how fast the cylinders work. So 750 RPMs, revolutions per minute, Sivvim Ledaka, is when a tank engine is on idle. 1400 is when it, like, you know, is ready to go. And what you do basically is when you hit the gas pedal, that screw turns. They had actually left the screw unscrewed. So it was 1400 RPMs instead of 750. When the driver turned on the engine, because they were checking the oil, Arola was standing in back, and the jump and the tank was in reverse and jumped backwards and crushed him against the bitonada, against the, whatever, a cement piling. And it was a terrible, terrible story. And this, of course, is Danny Marzitz and Didi Cohen. I told some of you his story yesterday. They also learned here. They were in my year. They fell in Lebanon in 84. David Deutsch also accidentally killed in a terrible accident. He was run over by an army trailer in a maneuver. And I think the reason that this is here is because before we go up to learn Torah, we remember that in this yeshiva, that comes with a price. You know, remember how many, you know, it's easy when you go to the army to understand that you have a responsibility, that, you know, you got to take this seriously. When you get back to the army, it's very hard to sit and learn. Remember that there were boys who were willing to give up everything and take this learning seriously. It's a gift that we have. And that's a very mixed emotion. It's a heavy load that you carry in a place like this. Come follow me. I'll show you a couple more things. When I came back from Pittsburgh, I went there really because my wife's mother got sick and they offered me a job at the same time. We thought it'd be healthy for her to be around, like, the, you know, the baby. My mom was just born. So you go to a place like that and there's really no one around, so you feel like you really know something, you know. I just finished my rabbinical smicha, and so Rabbi Friedman this and Rabbi Friedman that, and you kind of feel like, yeah, you know. Then you meet people and they grew up in a desert. I mean, Pittsburgh is a Jewish desert on certain levels. Maybe not compared to Topeka, Kansas, but compared to New York and to Israel. So you actually start to think you know something. So I decided I wanted to take a year and learn when I got back. I knew I'd never get that chance again. Very healthy experience. You know, you go to Pittsburgh, you feel like you're so great, you know, and then you come back here and it's like, you know, people here, come take a step forward so people, because this is a path, so that people should be able to get into the base medrash. People here, like, you know, geniuses grow on trees. Like, you've only studied the Talmud in its entirety 5 times? Oh, well, come back when you've done it another dozen or so, you know, like, it's a little intimidating. I only brought you out here because we have this image of the yeshiva. You know, like you sit in yeshiva and it's like, you know, this dirty, dank, dark, disgusting place. And there was a time and there was a value for that. Pat b'melach tochal, the Mishnah says, eat bread and salt, lie on the floor, wallow in misery, and deny all the comforts of the world because you should serve only God. There is a place for that philosophy, but I don't think our generation is in that space. And Rav Amital, when he was building this yeshiva, so people said to him, what are you spending so much time on the building? Spend time on hiring the right rabbis. He says, you know what? We've passed that time. If you want people to come in masses and learn Torah, they need a comfortable place to learn. Because otherwise they're going to Harvard. And, you know, when you hear that, you know, a guy spends years in yeshiva, you think like, whoa. But then you come to a place like this, it's not so difficult. I mean, these are the dorms, right? This is called Har Etzion, but everybody calls it the Gush. Right? And there are dorms here for like 500-600 students. And Alon Shvud is even more beautiful. You know, the gardening, and I can't tell you how many great discussions I've had on this lawn, and I'll show you in a minute the view, the different perspective, you know? Come, I'll show you something else that's interesting. It's a good picture. That building is the traditional yeshiva, okay? Over here is the teacher's degree section, and this is the library for the teacher's degree program. And you have, in terms of pedagogy and methodology in Hebrew, everything you can possibly imagine. Slideshows, video, webcam, on any Jewish topic you can think of. You know, you're doing a program for handicapped kids on Hanukkah in the Ukraine. You can come here and you can find. They're linked up to the web. They're linked up to the Bar Ilan computer. Any program that was ever run in the Ukraine, any program that was run for handicapped children, unbelievable, right? And you can put together a program just sitting in the library in an hour and a half, right? But this is one of the most important places in yeshiva. This is where I used to come when I just needed some air. You know, it gets intense. You're studying 12, 15 hours a day. You need a little air. You know, does God exist? Doesn't God exist? So pit stop number one was the candy machine. And this was pit stop number two. That is Rosh Tzurim. Now you can see the kibbutz very clear. It's beautiful. In the distance is Yerushalayim. That's Jerusalem. See?
Where?
Right there in the distance between the mountains. That's Jerusalem. See how the Beit Midrash points that way? And that's the edge of Efrat over there.
That's Elazar.
Over there. This is Rosh Tzurim, Kibbutz Rosh Tzurim. Jerusalem in the distance. Neve Daniel up on the hill. Elazar in the foreground. Efrat over there.
And you see that they're trying to build a ring of yeshivim on the mountaintops. Come, I'll show you something else.
A ring of what?
What? Of towns, settlements.
We're going to go, this is the library. This is absolutely one of the most amazing libraries of Jewish books in the world. In terms of Sfarim, like, you know, holy books in Hebrew, it doesn't have a big English section, but any book that you can think of and you can find is probably here. It's a huge library, right? When Endless Light's in Hebrew, they'll find it and they'll get it, absolutely. They have an English library, but it's not large. It's an amazing place to learn because of who else learns here. I actually used to come here sometimes when it was too noisy in the Beis Medrash. You know, in the Beis Medrash, when you have people studying b'chavruta, like, you know, in partnerships, there's 1,000 guys, it's like a roar. I mean, it's unbelievable how loud it gets. And sometimes it's very powerful, and sometimes it's like a little overwhelming, so I'd come down here and learn. There's a room I'm going to take you into and show you a couple things. We're only going to be in here about 5-7 minutes. But when we go into the library, it is a library, so in here I just ask, okay, shh, for the next 5 minutes, don't talk until we get inside a room. Because it's nice of the fact that they don't mind that I bring a group in here, but we really are encroaching on their space, and there are people sitting and learning, and I don't want to interrupt them, okay? So let's just keep it down while we go in there. Come. Oh, Shalom.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Baruch Hashem. How's the holy sofa?
Great.
Yeah?
Are you bringing them?
Yeah. Just coming in for a minute.
Whoa.
Shh. Quiet. And look at that. We're just going to go over here for a second. These are some of the oldest manuscripts in the world of Jewish content, okay? This is a manuscript of the Rambam, okay, from 13th century Provence, all right? It was found as part of a burnt library in Provence about 160 years after the Rambam died. And there's a big debate in Yeshiva as to whether this is an original copy of the Rambam, in which case that might be the handwriting of the Rambam, which is just unbelievable. You know? Come follow me. Every yeshiva student has certain books that he needs all the time. Like, for example, a 4-volume set of the Talmud, a 2-volume set of the Rambam, Maimonides. These are just when you're studying here, you know, you're reading this Talmudic text, and you have to look up that Talmudic text, and you have to look up the Rambam, and, you know, you're looking all over the Talmud, you don't have time to go out and get the tractates, right? So every student pretty much gets his own 4-volume set. If we have a chance, I'll show you in the Beis Medrash. If not, you'll have to imagine. And then, like, there's like 6 or 7 books, a copy of the Chumash, of the whole 5 books of Moses, all the prophets, the Nevi'im, right? Like 6-7 books that every student has. And when you come down here to learn, because you're working on something, so if you need to borrow those books because you're using them, there's a few sets in the library, it gets confusing. So they decided, they found someone who wanted to donate, right, sets of these books so that boys could sit here and learn, and they could go to a bookcase and just get those books. In other words, those bookcases, it's not like everywhere else where you have the Bible with the Bibles. Those are like user sets, you know? It's like having laptops. And you'll notice that each one of those bookcases is dedicated to one of the boys who fell in Israel, you know, from the yeshiva in Israel's wars. And I used to come down here and sit and learn. And this was just the place where I used to get away when I was in the first and second year. So when they did this project, I asked them to put Danny's picture on the place where I used to sit, which is right there overlooking this incredible picture of Yerushalayim, where that guy with the blue shirt is standing. So his picture's at the end. We'll walk by, but I'm not going to speak over there because I don't want to...
No.
Boy at the end is Danny. And you can walk around and see the pictures of the men who fell. Picture of Danny. And take a look at the books. Over there is a library from Rav Tamari, one of the great Torah scholars of Israel who died. And his family decided they wanted his books to be donated in a place where all of them would be used. He had thousands of books, so they donated them to the yeshiva here. And we'll walk around, and then I'm going to take you to another room over there which will blow your mind. Okay? So I'll just really quickly tell you what this room is, okay? So I'll just tell you really quick, this is an amazing story. If you look around you, you will see books. But these books are different from the books out there, because these books are hundreds and hundreds of years old, okay? I found Sfarim here that date back to like the 12th century. And you may wonder why they're not behind glass in a museum, okay? And I do want to say, if anybody's drinking anything, if your hands are cold, shouldn't pick up a sefer until they kind of warm up a little. So go like this, because it affects the sefer. That's what the librarian told me. We're not really supposed to bring food in here, but okay, just make sure not to make a mess. But in any event, I'll tell you the story. Close the door so we're not interfering with anybody. It's an amazing story. There was a fellow who had a son learning in yeshiva.
And he decided for a long time he had wanted, I don't remember the name of the village in Poland, so I apologize, somewhere in Poland. He had actually been a boy in Poland. And he was one of those boys that made it out of Poland, you know, just in time. And his family got out in, like, I don't know, 38, 39. And he remembered vaguely, you know, as a 5-6-year-old kid, you know, your year's age, being a child in Poland, remembers his house, remember whatever. His parents managed to send him, if I'm getting the story right, with a cousin or an uncle, and he got out, but his family did not survive, except for his father. And his father had told him stories as a kid about the house in Poland, whatever. And he always wanted to go back there, but his father never wanted to go back. And finally, the year that his son was in yeshiva, long after his father had passed away, he decided, he was already, you know, in his 40s, 50s, he was going to finally go and, you know, do that journey back to Poland to visit the place of his youth and to rediscover his past, on his way to visiting his son in Israel. And in this yeshiva, the yeshiva encourages, you know, parents to come. And, you know, like if you're a dad and you come to visit your son, this is a men's yeshiva. There's also, by the way, I don't know if you noticed, there was a woman sitting there. There's a woman's Hesde yeshiva called Migdal Oz, which is in Migdal Oz right opposite Efrat. It's actually run by the daughter of Rav Lichtenstein, who's one of the Rosh Yeshivas. And they've already got a couple hundred girls there. They all do, most of them do either national service or the army. They sit and learn for at least a year before they go. So that's just an incredible program also. But in any event, so he goes back to Poland, and he's looking for, you know, whatever, and he can't find anything. And he finally founds the house where, according to the address, he lived. But, you know, the fellow who lives there won't let him in. Doesn't want some Jew coming into his house, doesn't know what's going on, you know, doesn't want to take money. Just, you know, imagine some stranger shows up and says, you know, here's $50, can I see your house? Like, get out of here, you know, who are you, right? So he's like walking around, not sure what to do, and he figures he'll try to find out where the synagogue is. And nobody can tell him where the synagogue is. And then somebody, an older guy, remembers there was a synagogue down the street. And he goes, damn. Anyway, he's walking around. There's no synagogue because, of course, the synagogue was destroyed. Nothing left of it. But there's an old fellow sitting out in front of one of the, you know, like a pub or a cafe, who looks at him and yells out at him, you know, won't say his last name. What did it say? Levine, right? It's not his real name. Levine! So the guy turns around and he looks at him and goes, how does this guy know my name? Now, he looked very much like his father. Okay? So this fellow had obviously recognized him, because he looked like his dad. So he gets into this discussion. The guy knows no English. They find somebody who knows a little English. Turns out that this guy was the janitor of the synagogue, okay, in this town. And she says, where's the synagogue? So the guy says, no synagogue. He says, but I have a gift for you. Come with me. So he follows this guy. Now the English guy is, you know, the translator's gone. He's trying to make sense of what he's telling him. He's following him down alleyways. He's getting a little nervous. He's in some Polish village. Takes him into his house. They go into his house, takes him down to his basement. And in the basement are boxes and boxes of books. Because this janitor was the janitor of the synagogue. And we realized that when the Nazis came, the first thing they would do is they would burn the synagogue. When he didn't want the Jewish books to be burned. So he took all the books, he boxed them, he took them out of the synagogue, and he hid them in his basement. And he figured one day, eventually, the Jews will come back, and then they'll have the synagogue books, and maybe he figured he'll get a job, and whatever it might be. He said, look, I have these books. I've been waiting for somebody to come back. I never had the heart to throw them out or to get rid of them. They're yours. They're not mine. I don't know what to do with them. Take them. Now imagine you show up, you know, you've got your one suitcase. You're ready to fly and go through customs. Now you got to figure out, you're in the middle of a Polish village with like 20 boxes of books. So what do you do with them? But what, you leave 20 boxes of books? So he decides that if Hashem puts him in this place, he has to find a way to get these books to Israel. So I'll spare you the long detail on how he gets a truck and how he gets, you know, he doesn't know any Polish and how they manage to get it through customs. And he calls up Gush and he asks them if they're willing to take these books. And he doesn't know, he hasn't looked at what these books are. He just sees the Jewish books. He picks one out, Talmud, whatever. And so he hasn't really looked at them. So the yeshiva's like, well, you know, we don't really need more books. Baruch Hashem with lots of books. So he starts telling the story. And so they say, all right, you know what? This sounds like a mitzvah, so bring them. We'll figure it out. So he says to them, I'll make you a deal. I'll give you these books, but the deal is, they have to be on display. Like, I want them to be used if they come from such a place. So they say, fine. So he forgets about it. He goes to yeshiva, gives them the books, you know. Takes a few months. They go through them. They start to catalog them. And they discover, right, they discover a version of the Rif of Yitzhak Alfasi, who was the Rebbe of Rashi, that was written in the time of Rashi. They discover unbelievable manuscripts here. Okay? And they call the guy back up and say, listen, you know, we know we told you to put this out on display, but you don't realize what you're looking at here. And he said, I don't care. Like, what's the point of having an old volume of the Rif if nobody can learn from it? Like, at least their book should survive. And so they decided, and eventually they got this guy to donate it, they decided to build a separate room. So at least if they're going to be on display, that people should take care of them. These books are not allowed to leave this room. People can come and study from them in this room. Since then, other books have been added. There are lots of them. I'll show you one because it's amazing. This, by the way, is the original card catalog of that synagogue library, right? This is a facsimile of Haggadah that's 800 years old, and so on and so forth, okay? But this is the one, to be honest, that most amazes me. It's actually a later edition, okay? And just here, hang on a second. I'll just read this to you. In fact, they're learning from this Talmud here, I see. Okay, but I'll tell you what's amazing. This is a Gemara, right? What's interesting about this Gemara is when this Gemara was written. Okay? This is a much more modern Gemara. This Gemara was published, all right, in 1948 by the Vad Agudas Harabanim Be'ezol HaAmerikai, by the Rabbinical Association in the American Zone, and it was published in München, Heidelberg, in Munich. This was the first Shas, the first set of Talmud that was published in Germany. It was published by the American Army after World War II.
Why would they do that?
Pardon?
Why would they do that?
This was a symbol, the American chaplaincy, the chaplaincy of the American Army. Rabbi Samuel A. Snaig, chairman and chief rabbi of the U.S. Zone, they were determined to demonstrate that the Nazis had not succeeded. Mm-hmm. So you can learn in Israel from a Talmud that was published in Germany right after the Holocaust, here in Olam Shvut, which blows my mind, you know? There are a lot of different Sfarim here. Right, some of these books are very, very, very old. In fact, one of these books had to be repaired. I don't know if you know anything about how books used to be made, but the bindings of books are basically paper. They would take pieces of paper and put them together. So they were fixing the binding, and to fix the binding, they had to cut open one of the covers of the book. Here's a perfect example. If you look on the side of this book, okay? So this is different pieces of paper compressed together. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have machines back then, right? So they cut it open, and they found inside, when they were fixing it, a letter that was 500 years old. Okay? And it was a letter, wait, you're not finished yet. It was a letter from someone, a fellow named Yaakov, to another fellow, and it basically seems to imply that this fellow was writing to his relative because the Spanish Inquisition was coming. Can you imagine? So, you don't even know what's in these books. This is, one second, look at this beautiful handwriting. Right, be careful, Yair, be careful. It's a very old Sefer, yeah, you can hold it. This is a tour. This is a tour. The tour was written by the son of the Rush, okay, with the commentary of Rav Yosef Karo, the Beis Yosef. We're going to talk about him when we get up to Tzfat. Right, okay, this was published in 1811. This is like a more modern Sefer.
More modern.
Right?
1811.
And this is the laws of Shechita, the laws of ritual slaughter. One second.
It's Atzchim.
This is from Amsterdam. This is a seal. Like some of these Sfarim, they moved around. This is from, this particular Sefer has a stamp that it once belonged to a synagogue in Amsterdam.
How did they do Sfarim before?
Before printing presses, they wrote them by hand. The oldest book here that I know of is that book that was published in the time of Rashi. You're talking about 1060, 1070. So you have to understand dates then. Before like 1750, they didn't write in Sfarim 1755.
Yeah.
They chose a verse, and they made the letters of the verse bigger that represented the dates. You have to add them up to get to the date. So, you know? Alright, we're going to head back towards the bus, guys. Just a reminder to keep it down when we go to the library, okay? Does anybody have any questions about today? While we're at about yeshiva life, there was a special. This is part of Yemei Iyun. 3 days in the summer, people come from all over the country, and they present educational topics. And so the adults come from all over. It looks like the lecture just went out.
And that's a lot of guys, like, they're not, like all, like, dressed up. Like, they're mostly, like, casual people. So,
right.
Like, standard.
Right, yeah. Even less than in America. In America, guys wear, like, a white shirt. They're here, you know, this is, like, normal dress for yeshiva. Here, in this yeshiva. Alright, food is great.
Yeah,
yeah, I told you that if you eat well at lunch, you're going to learn well in the afternoon. That's basically the deal. I mean, it takes a while. It's not an American style diet, but yeah, no. The Netziv, when he was in yeshiva, I'm sorry, the Turatmima, who was the nephew of the Netziv, so he went to Valazhna, where the Netziv was. And after a couple months, they complained that they all the time served this gruel for lunch. They had, tagin meant like a different day. Muntag was Monday, and Slistag was Tuesday. And every different day, they would set up yeshiva boys to eat at a different family, right? So he used to complain that there were two families that he had, and all they served was this slop, this gruel. So the tzitz was very upset. So he found out which family they were, that his nephew was eating at, and he arranged that he should receive only slop, the exact same slop, at all of these places that he was eating for the next 3 months. That's all he should eat, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. He wanted to teach him, right, the obvious message. This is food, you make a bracha on it. This isn't how you become a Talmud Chacham, by worrying about what you eat for dinner. We're not the Torah Tamima. You know? It really hit me when I got out of the army. So in the army, you get used to eating can you watch my gun for a second? Hang on a sec. Yotzim anachnu shama od 10 shniot. Ta yachol la'alot, bsader?
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.